Hey everyone, my name is Chris, and this is another episode of New School Critics. Today we're going to be talking about Ozark Season 3. I previously done episodes on Season 1 and Season 2, with the main takeaway being praise for the show, especially the fact that it continues to evolve, right? Season 1 really started us on the ground floor of the birds getting swept up in cartel business and needing to launder money for the cartel and moving out from Chicago to the Ozarks to try to make that a reality and survive, with much of the tension coming from Marty and Wendy's marriage and how the kids are going to react not only to the move, but finding out to what Marty's involved in. And season one, you see how they come to terms with a lot of that and what they do to survive. And you have a lot of lower stakes, right? You have them laundering through a bar, through a funeral home, through a strip club, and there's some life and death scenarios, but the tensions with locals and maybe an FBI investigation that could come to fruition. So it was intense, but also kind of small. Season two ramps that up to the next level. You have them getting involved with politicians and governors and the Kansas City Mafia and other drug dealers that have a very established business. The cartel becomes more of a force with Helen Pierce showing up and how forceful she is representing the interest of the cartel and how kind of just velociraptor-like she is. And that was really cool to see because I feel like a lot of shows don't like to change the status quo too much. What they establish up front, you stay in that scenario and just kind of see the characters bouncing off of each other and having tensions within that scenario. Where in this show, the characters are often reacting to very changing circumstances, and the changes in those circumstances cause them to have different stresses and reactions and responses. Which I like that little switch. That was one of the things that I thought was so powerful about Breaking Bad. And I think Ozark and Breaking Bad, I've made the comparison. I think it's probably the most apt comparison, that this very much is a show inspired by the style and tensions and greatness of Breaking Bad and borrows from a lot of that show's strengths. And with that, you see Walter White start as just a high school teacher who starts making crystal meth to improve his life. And then he just keeps ramping up until he's the head honcho, right? And he's the one that knocks, and he's Heisenberg, and there's all this power and tension to the character that you watch develop over the course of the seasons. And his circumstances change season to season, the conflicts change. That's awesome. And Ozark is doing kind of a similar thing, which just as we see the birds rise in power. With season three, that continues as they're now much more established. Instead of being behind the scenes, they're now getting much more upfront and becoming the faces of the cartel. Not just in America per se, but they're definitely making themselves more known as players in the field, both politically and criminally, which puts a lot of the tension of the season in how they respond to those pressures. One, the public scrutiny and just how do they raise their profile and become more legitimate. Two, working closer to Navarro, the head of the cartel, and getting in with him to raise their stock so he is less likely to kill them because they're no longer as expendable. And then three, because they are becoming more public-facing, because they are rising in the cartel, they have more issues and woes with the FBI. So you have Marty and Wendy really having to balance those forces on them and what's it mean and how do they survive that and how do they come out on top of it all. So there was a lot that I really loved about this season, specifically the character Ben, Wendy's brother, who comes in. I feel like he brought a really charismatic spark to the show and a nice outside perspective into it. While also bringing kind of the charm that he had and a tragedy. Like, the character is such a tragic figure, and the show, it takes a spin into the mental health of Ben and him dealing with his bipolar disorder and what that means, and seeing really how he goes from the best version of himself to the worst version of himself and how that complicates matters. It's really kind of a deviation from the main tensions and stories that are going on, which I think some people could be critical of, but it's also, I think, the most powerful thing that the show has done, and the ramifications of Ben's arc is going to be huge, as it causes a definitive, it seems, split between Marty and Ruth. It might be something that unites Marty and Wendy in a way that they weren't united by before, while also causing issues with Helen and the birds that resulted in Helen's demise at the end of the season, which was shocking as can be. So the show really used the ancillary nature of Ben to their advantage in terms of the main plots, even though his character arc was only going to be this season. The ramifications of that character are going to carry far along. So in a lot of ways, this was my favorite season of the show, but I also think that there's some issues that in the aftermath of it, having time to think back on it, I'm like, hey, wait a second. That bothered me just a little bit, which I would compare that to Christopher Nolan movies. I almost always love a Nolan movie the first time I watch it. I see it, I think, wow, this guy's so great. Like, that was amazing. The way that he balances the epic with entertainment. Man, I can't wait for his next film. And then a couple hours later, thinking about the movie, I'm like, wait. Oh, no, wait. I didn't like that, did I? Like, that bothered me, didn't it? So one example is just the fact, like, I always harp on The Dark Knight, because I think it is commonly pointed to as not only the best superhero movie, arguably the best Christopher Nolan movie, and arguably one of the best movies of the 21st century so far. People love that movie, and I do as well, but over the years, there have been more flaws that I've seen where I'm just like, oh, he really swept that under the rug. And what I mean by that, not to just keep being generic with it, is that I think there are often scenarios that Nolan is really good at hiding the fact that there's maybe some logic issues in the scene or idea, just by how he cuts the movie, edits the movie, the power of the score, just the scene kind of carrying you along. You don't realize it until you think back on it. So in The Dark Knight, you have a scene where Bruce Wayne's throwing a fundraiser for Harvey Dent, and the Joker crashes it because he's looking for Dent, because he thinks Dent's Batman. And all these people, like these very wealthy Gothamites, are in danger because Joker's there with his henchmen. We know Joker kills people. We know he's a rising threat to the city. And Joker is going to throw Rachel, Bruce Wayne's love interest, out the window. And that's when Bruce shows up as Batman, tells Joker to let go of the girl, and Joker pushes her out the window. Batman dives after her, catches her, lands on the car, and they survive. He breaks their fall, and they kind of have a moment of small talk, and then we move on. And when you're just watching it, you're like, oh, yes, of course he saved Rachel. Like, he saved the woman he loved, but it's complicated because she's with Dent. Oh, we'll see what happens next. But when you think back on it, you remind yourself that Joker was at this party full of people, and Batman was right there. Like, Joker has been a bigger and bigger threat to the city, and this is the first time that they've interacted. And is there no more immediate action from Batman in that moment to try to stop Joker right then and there? Is Joker realizing that, oh, Batman's there, I need to escape? How'd that scenario end? Did Joker kill people at the party? Did he just run away and go down? Like, did he flee via helicopter? Did he go out a back door? Did he take the elevator down? Did Batman wait there for him to leave? Did Batman go back up to try to stop him? Like, it's just not a situation where I think you can cleanly cut away and not resolve the scene. But that's what Nolan does. And he does that, like, quite often. Or he'll do something in, like, Dark Knight Rises. He has Batman go and paint a bat symbol on a bridge that the government has shut down. The United States government has the army guarding this bridge to make sure nobody can leave Gotham, because Bane has threatened to blow up the city if anybody tries to leave Gotham. And yet Batman somehow takes however long to paint a giant bat symbol on the bridge that he can then light on fire to make an announcement that he's back in the city. Nobody on the bridge looks up and sees him painting that. He has all the gear available to paint this thing. It would have had to take like buckets of flammable liquid. So he just hefts those all over to the bridge. Nobody notices. He gets them up to the top. Nobody notices. He rappels down and kind of swings back and forth, painting the bridge. Nobody notices. It's just such a weird thing to think through of how did he do that? Where Nolan just kind of cleans it up and you only see the end result. And you're like, oh, awesome. Of course, Batman. Interstellar is another movie where one of the bigger tensions is Matthew McConaughey as a parent and the relationship he has with his son and his daughter and kind of the opposing viewpoints the son and daughter have. While the daughter stays loyal to her dad, the son becomes embittered by Matthew McConaughey going into outer space and never returning. So as they age, the girl becomes a scientist. She is trying to solve the problem while the son's just an angry farmer. And at the end of the movie, the daughter's trying to save everybody and the son's going to get people killed. And you don't see what happens to him, really. You just assume that he dies, that he doesn't flee with everybody else. And when Matthew McConaughey finally ends up coming back through some time travel, time loops, wormhole stuff, he's the same age, essentially, and his daughter's an old woman. And you get this lovely scene between them that's really powerful, really cathartic, as they finally get to reunite and get to just have a moment together. How lovely. But Matthew McConaughey never asks what happened to his son. He doesn't ask her about it, doesn't ask anybody else about it. Nobody ever tells him. It's just such a bizarre thing for a dad who only cared about getting back to his kids to just give up on the son because we're supposed to just think that the son is bad, even though he wouldn't have known that. He didn't see any of that. He still would have had some betrayal because I think his son sent kind of a mean message to him, but you don't think that he would say, it bothers me. It just bothers me a lot. And there's things like that in Inception, in The Prestige, and Batman Begins, Dunkirk. There's just little things like Dunkirk is told out of time. You have multiple sequences. You have the people at the beach waiting for safety. You have a ship that is going out to try to rescue these soldiers that have been marooned and in need of rescue. And then you have a fighter pilot that's kind of flying around and you cut between all of them. But each one is happening at different points in time. So if you were to tell the story linearly, you would start with all the boat stuff kind of going along, and then some of the soldier stuff would happen, and then some of the fighter pilot stuff would come at the end, and they would all kind of merge at a certain point. But that would slow the pace of the movie down so much, especially because the boat stuff is really boring. So you can't tell that story in a linear fashion and have it be as compelling. So what does Nolan do? He chops it all up and starts telling the story out of sequence, which has a nice effect when we're talking about like pacing and the revelation of the story and just what you can do with it. But there's no actual reason for that chopping up. There's no point that supports it. It's just done because the pacing of the movie would be uninteresting otherwise. And for some people, they won't care about that at all, right? It's a very, I would say you could argue, petty thing to care about. But I also just think when I already have an issue with the way in which Nolan manipulates flaws in his scripts and kind of overlooks things that could potentially damage a story or that he couldn't figure out how to solve, but is clever enough to mask them, it just bothers me a little bit more where you're like, yeah, you couldn't find a way to make this compelling that way. So you solved it, which is cool. And that is a solution, but it has no purpose. Where you think back to Memento, right? One of his first movies, and the sequencing of that movie actually makes sense because the character struggles to remember. So when it's told in reverse, the function of that matches the form of the character's own mental state. Same thing with something like Fight Club. It hides a lot of information from you. It's told in a chaotic fashion, but it fits the mental insanity of the character and the struggle that they're going through at the time. So there's this nice form and function matchup. I just don't think you have that in Dunkirk at all. It's purely for structural purposes. So Ozark, back to Ozark, because this is a podcast episode on Ozark season 3. I think that there's a similar concern in some ways that the show is starting to maybe hide a bit behind its escalating plot, the fact that it's having some stagnation and repetition in the show, especially around the characters of like Marty and Wendy, their relationship, and just the fact that we keep kind of coming back to similar tensions. So it's like Marty and Wendy in season 1, their relationship was on the rocks because Wendy was cheating on Marty, and you know, Marty knows, and they struggle to make it work. They're on the outs, but then they, through the trauma of the move and what they're dealing with, rekindle their relationship. But then season 2, it starts to fall apart again. Maybe Wendy's gonna cheat on him with this politician guy. You don't know. He likes her, but she stays loyal, but they still fight. But ultimately, they end up on the same team. And then season 3, you start and they're at odds again. They're still being really nice to each other at the beginning, but they're going behind each other's back, trying to sabotage each other's vision for the family. And once again, it leads to them having a big blow up in the middle of the season where they're on the outs. It looks like their marriage is over, but then events happen that bring them back together again, and they care for each other and I guess love each other. Just 3 seasons in a row of exploring that same tension gets a little boring. And I think Wendy, they give a little bit more to. In season 2, we got to see the rise of her ego. Season 1, she's just very capable. Season 2, she's capable and knows it. And the ego enters into the picture more, and she tries to exert more dominance in the scenario. Season 3, that dominance starts to become undermined. Her ego takes a step too far, and she actually starts to make mistakes and missteps and overplays her hand quite a bit. And by the end of the season, she ends up pretty broken via the death of her brother, but also because she's gotten them so indebted to the cartel, and Navarro is proving himself not to be somebody that you can manipulate or woo in the way that Wendy thought that she could, which puts a lot of danger on the family that wasn't present. She also, to a certain degree, alienates Helen, and Helen, being the attorney for the cartel, had a lot of power, and they spend a lot of the season humanizing Helen, which was cool, making her far more of a character rather than just a threat. You meet her daughter, she's starting to become friends with the birds, and then that kind of switches. So even though she's still this machine that feels very dehumanized at times, she's desensitized to murder, violence. She'll do anything that she needs to do to protect the cartel. There's still a human element that they bring into the picture that rounds her out a bit more. And at the end of the season, when Navarro chooses the birds over Helen, there's a bit more emotion and sadness to her death, just because we've gotten to spend time with her daughter. We know that she was trying to help the birds more than she would have tried to help somebody else, but they also kept fucking up and put her into a bad spot as well. I think if there's praise for the show, that's one of the things that it's made almost the characters outside of the birds more compelling and fascinating than the birds themselves, to where I almost wouldn't mind other people winning at this point, which I think just speaks a lot to how well they've developed the other characters. But it also points to maybe the fact that Marty and Wendy have started to become a little bit annoying, a little bit stagnant. I mean, Marty's character arc in this season was more, he's afraid and wants to get out, loses that, gets brought to the cartel, and goes through kind of a trial of the soul, and he has to confront a lot of his past while he's being held prisoner. And when he finally gets out of the cartel clutches, he passes their test and gets sent back home. He's there with a renewed attitude of victory, Like, I am going to beat these people. They even related to him being obsessed with a video game and wanting to beat the game, to beat the boss. And in this case, Navarro is the boss. The cartel is the game. And can he maneuver in the way that he needs to win? And money was the thing that allowed you to keep playing and to keep winning this arcade game. As long as you had quarters, you could keep going. So there is some nice tension there, but in development there, as we learn more about the character and he gets more of a sense of direction. But Marty in season one and season two was already very determined. He was already very capable. So the fact that we just have him become even more determined, is it that much of a revelation? Is it that much of character growth? So I just think there's some issues there, and especially with Ruth as well. I know Ruth is a fan favorite character. She's the Jesse Pinkman of the show, the sidekick. If Marty is to Walt, Marty and Wendy are to Walt, Ruth was the Jesse in that situation, bringing it back to Breaking Bad. And she, in season one, was distrusting of Marty, but intrigued by him and the life that he offered, the intelligence that he had, how different he was from the local Ozark environment. And she falls in with him and proves herself to be a capable assistant. But there's a point in time where she's looking to kill him and take his money before changing course and helping him. Season two, they start both on the same page, working together. But when her dad enters back into the picture, she chooses her dad over Marty, robs Marty, and is going to betray him until she finally picks Marty over her dad. Repetition again of those character arcs. And then in season three, she's working with Marty again, but grows more and more frustrated because of Marty not showing her the proper respect she feels she deserves in relation to the Kansas City Mafia and the struggle she's having with Frank Jr. Kid's mean. He's like an asshole. He's very entitled. He's causing a lot of issues, but Ruth is also not showing any respect. She's being very Ruth and causes a lot of conflict with Frank Cosgrove Jr. And she ends up doing awful things to him. He ends up doing way worse things to her, beating her nearly to death. And that conflict is dire. And she wants Marty to kill Frank Cosgrove Jr. She's untouchable, right? So because he touched her, something needs to be done to him. And yet Marty won't do it because he's playing the political game, which causes them to have a falling out again, especially with everything as she's dating Ben. So there's even more of a personal connection because this is the one time in the show we've seen her become vulnerable, fall in love, have an emotional connection to somebody that's love, legitimately love. And then it's Marty and Wendy that are responsible. Ben himself, like Ben can't help himself and drives everyone to the point where they don't know what else to do with him. And it ends with his murder at the hands of the cartel. And Ruth can't come to terms with that. So she's not only betrayed career-wise by Marty, but she also feels betrayed in her private life, her emotional life, like with the death of the love of her life that she lays at the feet of Wendy and Marty. So you're kind of just seeing that she is broken in a way that she hadn't been before. And that's when Darlene enters into the picture and kind of recruits her. So at the end of the season, Ruth isn't even with the birds anymore. She's with Darlene. But we've seen this happen two other times now, where she was going to go with her uncles against Marty. She was going to go with her dad against Marty. And now she's going to go with Darlene against Marty. And I get why they're going that direction, and there is a cool tension there, and I'm excited to see how it plays out. But at the same time, they just keep repeating the same things with these main characters, which gets a little frustrating. And then Darlene's character in the first season, she's just a psycho, like a complete psycho. You know, it's her and her husband run another drug business, a local that the cartel has to work with. They're powerful people. And she's very murderous. She has a hair trigger temper and will kill, will do whatever's necessary. She's terrifying. on the level that Helen is terrifying, just in terms of, you know, they will take things to the extreme, little things. They just don't have a chill button built into their system. So Darlene in season one is terrifying. Season two, she ends up killing her husband, who she loves. And then season three, the show kind of humanizes her and makes her almost an anti-hero. Like, she has a confrontation with Wendy because there was this whole subplot with baby Zeke, and Darlene had killed the mom of Zeke, and then you end up having the dad die, so the baby's orphaned, and the birds are going to raise the baby, but because Darlene craves nurturing and doesn't have a child of her own, she demands the baby at the end of season two. So in season three, Wendy's like, I'm going to get the baby back, because she's riding her ego. And she tries to go and get the baby back by smacking Darlene, talking shit to Darlene until Darlene smacks her, hits her, and she's going to try to file a lawsuit and think that she won. There's so much ego in how Wendy goes about it. So much like pride in it, that you're almost rooting against Wendy in the situation. And when they're in court, it's Darlene that comes off as humble, as charming. It's Wendy that comes off as crazed and over the top. And the judge ends up ruling in favor of Darlene. And in that situation, the whole point of that, one, it shows that Wendy isn't as cool, calm, and collected and powerful as she seems, but it also makes Darlene more of the face rather than the heel in this encounter, to borrow some wrestling terms, where Wendy had always been our face in that scenario because Darlene was always the worst person. But now Darlene is coming off as a responsible, caring mom, even though that she's a psycho, while also getting with Wyatt, who, even though their age difference is like 40 years apart, Wyatt has had a really terrible life. Being raised by his uncles, his dad just being kind of a dick, his dad dying, his uncle dying, and then him having to care for his family, also being smart, but in an area that doesn't respect that kind of intelligence. For Darlene to see something in him, even though we know she's a predator, we know that she is a creep, she shows more kindness and love to Wyatt than anybody in the show has. So while you can be creeped out by the age difference in the relationship, there's also this sense of, you're happy that this character is finally happy, that he has somebody that's taking care of him, even if it's somebody that we didn't think would do so or do a good job of it, and we think could murder him at any point because she already murdered her husband that she loves. There's something, there's a really great tension there of wanting to support him, but also being creeped out by the scenario that he's found himself in. But again, it's one of those little things that inclines you to think more positively about Darlene than what you may have done in the past when she was just purely monstrous. Is it still arguably very creepy? Yes. But it still humanizes her in a way that she was lacking before. And then when she defends Ruth in a way that Marty wouldn't, that once again makes her more of this heroic anti-hero figure than Marty or Wendy. And when she goes and stands up to the Kansas City Mafia, she comes off as much more of a badass than Wendy and Marty. And you see her recruiting an army to go against Wendy and Marty. And it's weird because the show has been actively making us disinterested a bit more in what were our main protagonists, and now we're actively potentially rooting a little bit more for who had been the antagonists. That's a really cool sequence, and I like that a lot, but I also just think it's a very strange thing to be witnessing a show kind of throwing its main characters under the bus and raising up its more evil characters in a way that makes them more endearing. I'm sure there's a whole thing that you can get into about that of, is it good to end up glorifying or heroicizing some of these villainous people? Can we become endeared to people that have done and do awful things and are awful people? And where is that line? Usually that's reserved for heroes that start off in a good place or that seem to have a good heart, like Walter White in Breaking Bad, or you think of some of the characters in The Wire, like Omar is one of the most beloved characters in The Wire. He's a thief, he kills people, but he also has a code, he also takes care of people, there's a kindness there. You see that he's pure of heart than some of the people around him. He's the Robin Hood of the show. So you feel a little less negative about rooting for him. Same thing with Tony Soprano. As awful as Tony can be, you see a lot more of the good that he does from the onset and the way in which he cares from the onset and the complicated nature of his relationship with what he does. And you're humanized to him a bit more. But when you're introduced to the character as purely villainous and then have that unraveled and have them, it seems the show working to make them more heroic than what they were before, I don't know how I feel about that. On the one hand, I think it's an interesting way to thing to take the story and place to take the story to, and creates a dynamic where we're having the showdown between Marty, Wendy, and Darlene, and now Ruth on her side. That's cool, and I'm excited about that, but also how complicated. How very, very complicated. So the season overall, I liked a lot. And the Jonah, I think one of the most interesting things is what they've done with Jonah, the son of Marty and Wendy, in that Charlotte, his sister, has kind of just been her own thing. She was already 17 when they moved to the Ozarks, so she was annoyed by the move, but she was already kind of her own person and had her own ideas and concepts, and she hasn't changed much as a character over the course of the show, except becoming more accepting of what's going on. Jonah was much younger and much more impressionable. So season one, he is scared of what's going on, but also intrigued by it. Season two, he starts trying to help out and becomes more curious about it and more involved in some ways. And season three, that escalates even more to the point where he's helping his Uncle Ben try to protect Ruth and doing some more technology focused things to help the family. And at the end, actually takes a gun and chases down Helen. And what's fascinating about that is not only is he being influenced by this world that his family has thrust him into that's so violent and solves things through violence, but we know that he's Wendy's son, and how this season explores the mental decline and the mental health of Wendy and the mental health of Wendy through her brother. We see how bad her brother's mental health gets, which then makes us aware that Wendy, sharing the same DNA, could have a similar course. Not that she would, but it at least brings into the picture that her stability could go south in the way that her brothers potentially did. And we've seen her at times be just as much of a loose cannon as her brother was. Maybe not to the same degree as having like a manic blow up or meltdown the way that her brother did, but just in the ways in which she will live on the edge and really test her mortality or force things in a way that are dangerous, like breaking into her old family home and drinking and turning pictures. And it's just such a wild thing to do, but something that she does because she's a bit more of a loose cannon than what she portrays herself to be. Jonah is her child, and that we see that one side of the family is struggling so much with their mental health and he is under such stress. Is he also going to have issues? I think that's been a question that they've kind of been building to over the course of the seasons. So when he shows up at Helen's place with a gun and seems like he's about to kill her, there's really a tension of what is this kid capable of and where will he go? What will he do? Will he be more like Marty? Will he be more like Wendy? Will he be more like Ben? Are we seeing something tragic or something heroic? What's being forged? And in some ways, I think the story of Jonah is one of the most fascinating in the entire show. I just hope they pay off on it in a way that's satisfying. And I guess that covers the third season. And again, a lot of praise. I think it's one of the strongest seasons I've watched of a show, but there still are issues that make it less than perfect in a way to where just afterwards I'm kind of like, okay, there's more negatives here than what I thought when I first watched, but the positives far outweigh the negative. And in terms of Netflix shows, I feel like most Netflix shows just get worse season after season. I can't think of any that I thought have gotten better aside from Ozark. Live action, I feel like BoJack Horseman, my wife and I are in the middle of watching that. That's getting good and staying up to speed, but like animated so much different than live action. But that does it for Ozark season 3. If you have any thoughts, questions, concerns, please leave a comment either on the YouTube channel, or you can find me at Kanye Podcast on Twitter, or comment on the Film Colossus page for Ozark season 3. And would love to discuss more with you. You can also email me newschoolchris@gmail.com. If you want to support the channel, the easiest way is to subscribe if you're listening on a podcast format, or like, subscribe, comment if you're watching on YouTube. Otherwise, until next time, if you have any requests, hit us up. But this has been New School Critics. Cheers.